chapter 41, an Aryan vision. If by some calamity almost all the golden Labrador retrievers were killed, leaving only a small number of that admirable breed in the world, it would certainly be viewed as tragic if the survivors were not protected and preserved. Yet it would appear that some people care more about preserving a unique breed of dog than about continuing our unique and beautiful breed of humanity. How strange that the predicament of some whales and other endangered creatures can create even global concern and action, while the dire emergency facing the white race, the question of its very survival, goes largely unreported in the mass media of the world. Imagine if the government began a program to kill off the smartest, most accomplished, educated, and talented people. What if it confiscated the money of the intelligent, hard-working, responsible, and productive people, reducing their birth rates, and use their money to financially encourage high birth rates among the least intelligent, least successful, and most criminally active people in the nation? Those are precisely the policies of every government of the West. Our own government does not line up the most intelligent and productive against a wall and shoot them, but every Western society exterminates their precious genes over time by promoting the factors that lower their birth rates. In every civilized society, the least capable, least responsible, and least intelligent, as well as the alien flood of non-white immigrants, invariably have the greatest numbers of children. Most Western governments, through welfare programs, actually give economic incentives to the underclass to create more like themselves, while discouraging the productive from having more children by ruinous taxes. In the race history chapter, I discuss the paradox of civilization. With the passage of time, civilization rises, building upon its great art and architecture, experience and learning, technological and cultural achievements, and then, invariably, it declines, often far more rapidly than it rose. The brilliant philosopher Oswald Spengler, in his magisterial work of history, Decline of the West, surveyed ancient civilizations and offered the thesis that they were organic in nature. He suggested that each had remarkably similar stages that could be contrasted with a human lifespan having a period of gestation, birth, growth, decay, and death. He viewed these passages of civilization as inevitable life stages similar to the life cycle of a person. His pessimistic view of the West's decline seemed to come true in his realized predictions of Germany's devastation in the Second World War and the accelerating decline of Western civilization as the century ran its course. Spengler was certainly right about civilization seeming to have an organic life of its own. But when one understands race, it becomes apparent that civilization is only an external manifestation of something much deeper. The real essence of civilization, underneath the shiny exterior of its art and architecture, science and technology, is the genetic quality of its people. When early civilizations arose out of nothing, they were outward manifestations of the genetics of an evolutionarily advanced people. Biologists call the resulting upward appearance or expression of the interaction of the genotype with the environment the phenotype. Our Caucasian ancestors created a written language in a world of no writing. Where there was no wheel, they invented one. Where there were no buildings, save of sticks and mud, they constructed great edifices that required the skills of higher mathematics and engineering. They created from nothing what the African has never even successfully copied in mass. If poor environments keep people down, then our forefathers would have never risen from the mud at the edge of the ice fields of ancient Europe. In truth, an incredibly harsh environment over many thousands of years is precisely what made our people what we are. Before civilization, nature pitilessly killed those individuals and groups who did not have the genetic fitness to survive. Over thousands of generations, nature gradually elevated Western man until he finally broke the bounds of his environment and literally created a new environment, one called civilization. Its creation brought about both his greatness as expressed in its organization, form, and beauty, but also the seeds of his own downfall. For civilization begins a process that chips away at the best genes. The bounty created by civilization made survival far less dependent on intelligence, foresight, self-discipline, and courage. The rabble could live on the garbage scraps of the great, or submit to another generosity for their daily bread. The group altruism that arose in the Ice Ages, which enabled our people to help each other survive through the centuries of brutal ice and snow, found expression once civilization arrived. Through indiscriminate welfare and an understandable pity for the unfortunate. While the genetic elite found their greatest satisfaction in achievement and the luxuries of wealth and power, the lowly found it almost exclusively in sex. And while the brave and fittest went off to war to bleed, the cowardly and incompetent stayed home to breed. Finally, when civilized nations conquered lesser peoples, they brought their captives home as slaves, with whom they gradually interbred. Ultimately, their slaves' strands of DNA became entwined with that of their masters. All these factors destroyed the genetic vitality of the civilization. Spengler failed to see that it is not civilization that is the living organism, but the genotype beneath it. Great genes give it birth. Then as cultural and scientific achievements accumulate, and dysgenic policies take their toll, the genetic quality of the people degenerates until the shell of civilization collapses on the rotted core. Every civilization has failed, but nature has not. A chain of life arose on this planet from the lowest amino acids to the highest forms of consciousness and evolution. If we just continue the genetic progress of our kind, civilization can continue to evolve to higher forms, the same way that evolution has succeeded in elevating life from its simplest forms to the most advanced creations of God. It is now time for a new civilization and a new creed, one that recognizes the laws of the natural order. We do not have to follow the letter of the natural law as expressed in nature's capriciousness, only its spirit. We have the capacity to act on her laws with love and compassion, rather than with the brutality and indifference of the law of tooth and claw. What I came to realize was that maintaining the genetic strength of our civilization would prevent the decline that seemed inevitable from history. Furthermore, I saw that with our technology and culture paired with genetic advancement, new heights could be scaled that are scarcely conceivable today. For almost his entire history, man has concentrated his genius primarily on his education, his tools, his machines, and his ideas, rather than on improving his own inner quality. Through the practice of medicine, we attempt to cure the vagaries of illness, and many wise men have formulated prescriptions for a healthy life. But these efforts are akin to a mechanic keeping an engine running on an old Model T, repairing an occasional breakdown, rather than designing and building a more advanced engine. Modern efforts at education and training are similar to trying to make the Model T automobile engine capable of going 200 miles per hour just by feeding it a better grade of motor oil and a higher octane gasoline. It could be said that civilization actually wears down the engine and as parts become worn, they're replaced by less sturdy metal until finally the engine fails to run at all and the society falls to barbarism. Now, to learn how to make changes in the genetic structure to cure the biological breakdowns of disease and impairment. Someday we will harness the power of the genes, not simply to repair the failures of an old engine, but to create an infinitely more powerful engine that will cure the endemic social ills that plague us and speed us to higher levels of beauty and accomplishment. Count Otto de Gobenau began to understand these concepts midway through the 19th century, coinciding with Gobenau's study of the immediate role of the effect of races on civilizations. Charles Darwin, in his study of the changing and evolving character of all life forms, demonstrated that principles of heredity, combined with what he called natural selection, had developed the exceptional abilities of mankind itself. His masterpiece, The Origin of Species, has a subtitle that expresses his whole idea in a nutshell: the preservation of favored races in the struggle for life. As observant and perceptive minds began to understand the role of heredity in intelligence and other character traits, a whole new science came about, a science called eugenics. Sir Francis Galton, the pioneer researcher of human heredity, coined the term eugenics from the Greek eugenes, meaning well-born. He described eugenics as that science that deals with all influences that improve the inborn qualities of a race, also with those that develop them to the utmost advantage. From the very beginning, eugenicists had the highest humanitarian motives. Galton wrote the following in his Memories of My Life: "Man is gifted with pity and other kindly feelings. He has also the power of preventing many kinds of suffering. I conceive it to fall well within his province to replace natural selection by other processes that are far more merciful and not less effective." The idea began to grow that through the improvement of mankind itself, tremendous suffering could be lessened and the opportunities of mankind vastly improved. Darwin himself, after reading Galton's masterpiece, wrote him to say that he completely supported his point of view. By the early years of the 20th century, the eugenic idea and ideal had the endorsement of many of the leading lights of Western civilization. Scientists such as Julian Huxley and Sir Arthur Keith, playwrights and authors such as George Bernard Shaw, H.G. Wells, and Charles Dickens. It also had the endorsement of other outstanding personalities such as J. Maynard Keynes, the young Winston Churchill, Arthur James Balfour, British Prime Minister, and the President of the United States, Teddy Roosevelt. In his classic play, Man and Superman, George Bernard Shaw noted that, "Being cowards, we defeat natural selection under the cover of philanthropy." Eugenic concern is good for every race and every nation. Dysgenic, or genetic degeneration, trends should be just as important a concern for black people as they are for white people. For instance, black rural farm women near the bottom of the socioeconomic ladder have an incredibly high average birth rate of 5.4, while black women college graduates have an average rate of 1.9. less than needed to maintain their numbers. Such dysgenic trends mean that black problems will only intensify in the years ahead. Two schools of eugenic thought arose: positive eugenics and negative eugenics. What is called positive eugenics is simply encouraging the best to procreate. Teddy Roosevelt was its best known advocate. It could be characterized by generous tax breaks for taxpayers with children so that these generally competent members of the population are not penalized for having children while the indigent are financially rewarded for having them. It means letting those of achievement know that no matter how impressive their work, nothing exceeds the importance of passing down their inherent abilities and talents to the next generation. It means that when a spouse is infertile, and the couple opts for artificial insemination or in vitro fertilization, that they should select from the most genetically gifted of donors. Positive eugenics can also mean finding a way to let a career woman have children without penalizing her professionally, economically, and socially. Negative eugenics means no longer financing welfare illegitimacy and encouraging recipients' responsibility not to bring unwanted children into the world. It means encouraging those with serious genetic defects to adopt or utilize artificial or in vitro fertilization. It means protecting our borders from third worlders and stopping foreign aid to third world countries unless they agree to responsibility in regard to overpopulation. These policies will greatly lessen future human suffering and help preserve the Earth's ecosystem, as well as aiding those nations to create higher standards for their own people. One of my interviewers over the years, Evelyn Rich, once told me an amusing story about her mother in Scotland. It seems that whenever her mom gets an appeal for a donation to feed the starving of some third world country, she simply places a condom in the return envelope and mails it back. Enough said. When I served as a state representative, I consistently voted for programs to help the gifted. At the same time, I supported programs to assist the disabled and the mentally and physically impaired. I supported and sponsored with my fellow legislators events, such as the Special Olympics. As I watched the extraordinary children compete in the many events of the Special Olympics in New Orleans, I felt a joy for those children who were accomplishing what were, for them, Herculean feats. However, the joy became mixed with the sorrow of witnessing their painful struggle to attain physical standards that most of us take for granted. I pinned a blue winner's ribbon on a little 12-year-old girl named Lola, who sprinted 40 yards on her wobbly, deformed legs. When she crossed the finish line, I could see her crying, both from the physical hurt and from the joy of her accomplishment. She hugged and kissed me, and her tears moistened my cheeks. After witnessing a number of Special Olympics, I understood how good eugenic policies not only makes good sense, but was the only way mankind could someday see the day when no child is born congenitally blind or deaf or deformed or suffering in searing pain. Both the positive and negative variety of eugenics are keys to not only advancing the health, intellectual capacities, and desirable characteristics of mankind, they are truly the way to achieve the lessening of human pain and suffering. Not only will our future generations be born with fewer hereditary defects and diseases, but we can also have more productive and creative people from whom everyone benefits. To ensure that fewer children will have to endure impairment is a truly humanitarian cause. And when fewer are born that way, more resources are available for better care of those who do bear infirmities. The level of assistance of the mentally retarded and the physically impaired should be far higher than it is now. But it must be remembered that helping the impaired helps them only, while helping those of exceptionally high ability helps everyone, including the impaired. It is the children of genius who will likely devise effective technologies, treatments, and medicines to help the suffering, and also produce the societal wealth that enables the less fortunate to receive the costly care that they need. Society should make at least as much effort to develop the innate talents of the gifted as it does to maintain the impaired, In doing so, a better life can be created for all. After one of the events at the Special Olympics, a woman who obviously knew very little about my record supporting special children rushed up to me and hatefully asked, "Why are you here at the Special Olympics? With your views, you have no right to be here." She had heard the vicious and untrue allegation that I endorsed the killing of the mentally and physically handicapped. The Jewish extremist enemies that I have resort to no low kind of allegation or attack. I calmly pointed out that it was the fifth function for special kids and that other legislators and I had helped sponsor. "But you want to eliminate them," she protested. "Not them," I answered. "I want to eliminate the genes that give them their debilitation and their pain. I want to see to it that someday no other child ever has to endure what they do." She looked puzzled after my comment, and I offered to send her my complete position on the issue. We exchanged cards, and she melted back into the crowd. A few days later, a letter waited for me at my legislative desk, accompanied by a single, beautiful red rose. In her note, the lady who had verbally accosted me apologized and wrote, "I hated you before I really knew what you stood for, and I'm ashamed of that. I read your paper, and thank you for your intelligent and compassionate proposals for both making our impaired loved ones have better lives and greatly reducing the suffering of future generations." I am determined that the day will come when almost no child is born in pain and disfigurement, when every child has a chance for the beauty and the promise that life has to offer as a full human being with all the precious capabilities that human beings are meant to have, to walk and run and see and hear and taste and smell and feel and think and love and gaze upon the heavens with hope and wonder. The culmination of that vision is a humanity that develops far beyond what we are today to a higher level of evolution tomorrow. My dream is to see the foundations of a society in which the quality and abilities of people grow with every generation. We have it within our grasp to foster human beings with healthier, longer lives and more intelligence, more powers of memory, and more noble characters. I can envision a future society with few criminals and thus minimum need for restrictive laws, police, jails, and therefore a society with far more freedom. I can picture a future nation where a mother can raise her small children at home, if she so chooses, with no financial worry, where the finest education is based solely on the student's abilities and not on his parents' bank account, where the best student and the impaired child can get precisely the form of education they need to nurture their highest abilities. I can see a society in which the media teaches honesty, honor, courage, and accomplishment, rather than degeneracy of the human spirit. I can see a society where each person finds a greater personal joy in his own healthy body, engaged in athletic activity or absorbing the beauty of nature, rather than as a sedentary spectator. I envision a political system that elevates men to office based on the quality of their character and their ideas, rather than the special interest money that they can muster. I can see a healthy economy based on free enterprise, ingenuity, and competition, but one also based on honor and honesty rather than greed. I can see a medical profession oriented toward keeping people healthy rather than repairing the damage of unhealthy living. I can see a time when genetic research will cure cancer and diabetes and other diseases that ravage mankind. I can envision an earth of clean air and clean water, uncrowded and uncorrupted. I could see an artistic renaissance of Western man, love of beauty and form, replacing today's alien cult of ugliness. I can see painting and sculpture that represent an idealization of mankind, not the misshapen images of a debauched world. I hear music that not only arouses the senses and touches the heart, but inspires the spirit. I see a nation of one people, one heritage, a society where each citizen shares a great community of love and concern for each other, a nation that protects and nurtures the most precious treasure of our people, the children. There can never be a perfect society, and there will always be challenges for mankind, but only a more highly evolved mankind will be able to meet the unforeseen tasks ahead. There are many places on Earth where one can see a slight glimmer of the coming natural order of the 21st century. In those regions that are today populated almost exclusively by our race, we can find communities of good schools, clean streets, low crime, and feelings of real brotherhood. Many of our communities are essentially healthy in spite of alien media promotion of the degenerate and destructive, and despite school curricula, often damaging to our spirit. When our whole nation becomes a white community again of both substance and spirit, and when the media and our schools are a reflection of the highest of our Aryan ideals, the new millennium will truly arrive and the natural order will commence. Aryans seek far more than mere survival. We strive toward God. We fight for a new vision and a new world. We fight to fulfill our destiny on earth and in the stars. Once this vision becomes strong enough in our hearts and our minds, nothing can stop us from fulfilling it. Uncontrolled alien immigration and low white birth rates have created growing non-white percentages in formerly white nations, and will lead to whites becoming a minority if left unchecked. Once that occurs, whites will completely lose political and cultural control in their own societies. Social integration of the races, accompanied by aggressive media promotion of race mixing, has produced higher rates of racial intermarriage, further diminishing white numbers and lessening white allegiance in those mixed families. The inescapable fact is that unless there is a dramatic awakening of our people and a dedicated and well-organized resistance, our race faces a true biological Waterloo, the annihilation of our very genotype. In addition to the catastrophic white genetic losses of this century, there has been an accompanying deliberate subverting of the cultural and social institutions of Western mankind. What we want. We Aryans want the same kind of society for our children that our forefathers envisioned and created for us. We want an appreciation of Western art and music. We want a populace self-disciplined and self-reliant, healthy in body and spirit. We want a real sense of brotherhood and love that we know is only possible in a more racially homogeneous society. We want good schools, safe and clean streets and neighborhoods, and a chance for advancement based on merit and hard work. We want an honest system free from corruption and hypocrisy. We want our children to learn pride in our people and hope for the future. We want a society where we feel bonded to each other rather than alienated and deracinated. We want to be part of a great people, aspiring toward great accomplishments, improving with every generation, striving toward God. We know who we are. We are Aryans, racially conscious white men and women who are dedicated to the survival and evolutionary advancement of our people. We shall achieve the following. First, we Aryans shall survive. The most fundamental urge in all life forms is self-preservation. We shall see to it that our genotype lives and goes on just as we desire the preservation of other species and subspecies in the natural world. To us, there is nothing more sacred, no more sacred task than to preserve our race as a unique and evolutionarily advanced creation of nature. Our race has created magnificent painting, sculpture, music, architecture, philosophy, literature, poetry, government, scientific achievement, and religious expressions. Yet, in the final analysis, we don't have to justify ourselves to anyone but ourselves. We will obey the first law of life itself, self-preservation. Second, we shall have our own society created in our own image and populated by our own people, united in our common heritage, culture, and our shared faith for the future. We desire to live in our own neighborhoods, go to our own schools, work in our own cities and towns, and ultimately live as one extended family in our own nation. We shall end the racial genocide of integration. We shall work for the eventual creation of a homeland for African Americans and any other racial group that so desires it, so each race will be free to pursue its own destiny without racial conflicts and hatred. Third, we shall be free. We shall determine for ourselves our own destiny. Government and media must be of our own people, by our own people, and for our own people. It must not serve any other power but us and us alone. Only we know what's best for ourselves, our families, our nation, our race. Just as any good father and mother will put their own child's well-being first, our leaders must put our welfare first. America must again become synonymous with ourselves and our posterity. We don't seek to suppress anyone else, nor do we seek supremacy over any other race or other nations. But we know what's best for us, just as other races understand what's best for them. We shall have a government oriented to our own basic interests and values, committed to our own people's independence, freedom, and well-being, a government that puts America first and our race first worldwide. Fourth, we shall have a free press. We know that in the age of modern media, what is called democracy is really rule by an oligarchy, because only an unelected tiny few wield the great powers of the mass media, which in truth exceed the powers of a king or a president. The mass media must be free of alien domination and must become instruments that ennoble and strengthen our highest values, not debase them. Media power must serve our ideals, not pander to our weaknesses. Freedom of speech must be a sacred right for all our citizens, and at the same time, the great media powers must be in our own people's hands and in the service of our evolutionary destiny. Fifth, we want an advanced educational system that educates every person to the full measure of his or her ability and seeks out and nurtures those exceptionally gifted who will lead us into the future of science, the arts, and government. We want a system that teaches the fundamentals of life, language, and science, but even more importantly, trains the noble character. The first obligation of education to every child is to teach him honor, duty, honesty, respect, brotherhood, unselfishness, courage, self-discipline, and self-reliance. The next is to foster an appreciation of his heritage and how he is part of a never-ending upward chain of life, destined to live in a healthy and beautiful nation and on a renewed earth. We must consciously cultivate nobility among our people in both the spirit and the flesh and make ready for the next evolutionary step to a higher mankind. Sixth, we want a healthy and organic society based on natural order. We see man's purpose realized in understanding and applying the natural laws of life. We state those as 1. Racial integrity, the preservation of our racial genotype. 2. Natural hierarchy of individuals based on ability and contribution to society. 3. Leadership by the best, a political system that elevates those of best character and ability to leadership on every level. 4. Territoriality, through recognition of the sovereignty of nations and cultures and private property among individuals. 5. Family and motherhood, the promotion of healthy families and a sound economic structure that creates the financial means and the time necessary for mothers and fathers to give their children the nurture and guidance they need. 6. Respect for the earth, that the ecology of our planet be protected and replenished. 7. Eugenic and cultural evolution. Our ultimate concern must be that each generation takes another step up the evolutionary ladder. We must consciously promote the advancement of our science and the arts and our spiritual life while advancing the genetic improvement of future generations. Next section is A Visionary Fashions a Weapon for Truth. In October 1965, I first heard of Dr. William Shockley. I was an avid reader of the U.S. News and World Report, which at that time was certainly the most conservative of the big three news magazines, the others being Newsweek and Time. I read an article entitled Quality of U.S. Population Declining, and in it there was a long interview with Dr. William Shockley. In it, he dared to speak about racial differences in intelligence and about the declining genetic quality of mankind. Shockley must be included in any list of the dozen most eminent scientists during the 20th century. Shockley led the three-man team at Bell Laboratories that invented the point contact transistor, and he invented by himself the junction transistor, the analog and the junction field effect transistor. The transistor ushered in the modern electronic age and the computer age. For their major scientific breakthrough, he and his colleagues were awarded the Nobel Prize for Physics in 1956. Even before he won the Nobel Prize during the Second World War, he was director for research at the U.S. Navy Anti-Submarine Warfare Operations Research Group, and in recognition of his work, received the Medal of Merit from President Truman. Shockley went on to found the Shockley Semiconductor Laboratories, the company which formed the basis for the computer industry's famous Silicon Valley. His invention of the transistor was the essential breakthrough that made possible the computer revolution. He sold his company and accepted a prestigious chair at Stanford University, where he continued to conduct research and lecture after 1963. Dr. Shockley wasn't the type merely to rest on his laurels. His brilliant mind found itself drawn to a new and far more important scientific inquiry, the genetic quality of mankind itself. A pure scientist with little concern for fashion or popularity, but a great love for truth, he became convinced that human genetic quality was in jeopardy. In recognition of the crisis that faced our genotype, at the very pinnacle of his career, he put aside his love of physics and devoted himself almost entirely to his crusade to rescue our people. His concern for race and genetics had begun years earlier when he did research during the Second World War with the Army Air Corps B-29 group in India. While in India, he became interested in the problems of overpopulation because of the human misery he witnessed. In experiences similar to my own, he arrived at an understanding of the racial demise of the once great Indian civilization. Shockley's analytical mind quickly led him to see that the most important factors of a nation's well-being are the genetic qualities of its people. In 1968, he was invited to lecture at the Brooklyn Polytechnic Institute, but found himself drowned out by Marxist militants. At Dartmouth in 1969, Marxist demonstrators rioted and stopped his speech. In 1971, at Sacramento State College, militants again staged a violent disruption. At Staten Island Community College, he was to be part of a controversial speaker program that included Black Panther Bobby Seale. Shockley was canceled by the college administration. Seale was not. Even Harvard canceled his appearance schedule for April 1972 after a leftist disruption. Then in 1973, Harvard Law School again prohibited his appearance. The newspaper quoted a law school memo which stated, quote, "The realities and exigencies of a less than free intellectual climate outbalanced the desirability of our making a stand for freedom of speech." If one of America's most important Nobel Prize-winning scientists can't make a speech about an important scientific subject at a major university because of threats of violence and terrorism, then what exactly is meant when someone asserts that America has, quote, freedom of speech? Not only did Shockley face the violence of intolerant egalitarians and Marxists, he also faced the calumny of the press. A man who was vital to the American war effort against the Nazis in directing the anti-submarine research and development was dubbed a, quote, Nazi, simply for telling the truth about race. If Shockley deserved that label, then the press might as well go ahead and denote Washington, Jefferson, Lincoln, and Teddy Roosevelt as Nazis, too. They will probably get around to that eventually. The media also blatantly lied about the facts of the whole racial controversy in the largest and most influential magazines of the day. For instance, in discussing Shockley's ideas, Time magazine wrote that, quote, "virtually all scientists reject these views, of course, arguing that there is no sound evidence of intellectual differences based on race or of intellectual decline based on genetics." And by the way, as my awakening shows in the first half of the book, there are thousands of leading scientists, including people like Mr. Watson, who helped decipher the DNA itself, that says that race and genetics are critical in terms of the quality of our nations, our sciences, our educational process, and the like. The truth is that most psychologists recognize the fact that blacks have a lower average intelligence, and a majority of all the experts in the field believe that the racial differences in intelligence are at least partially genetic. In spite of all the hatred and wrath he endured, Shockley continued to enter the lion's den. He would not relent, recant, or retreat. His patents provided him all the income he would ever need to live a very comfortable life, but he still chose to take the hard and honest road for no other reason than the fact that he loved his heritage and he loved the truth. He was indeed a true Aryan. When I was 16, Shockley was my idol. A bespectacled, slight man stepping up to the assassination threats and physical intimidation to speak the truths crucial to our survival and evolutionary progress. His example influenced me to devote my life to the same ideals. In the mid-60s, though, my reverence for him came almost entirely from his racial writings and his courage in carrying them to the public. It wasn't until 2 decades later that I truly began to understand his ultimate significance. History will someday record Shockley as not only a great scientist who courageously fought in the public arena for the racial and eugenic truth, it shall also acknowledge him as the genius who created the tools vital for our eventual victory. In the 1960s, solid-state electronics was just coming into its own, and the personal computer was only science fiction fantasy. But from the transistor and the silicon chip transistor that Shockley created, a whole new world came into being. From his work came the modern communications revolution that included greatly expanded personal communication, affordable electronics, inexpensive long-distance communication, and ultimately, the Internet. In the last decade of the 20th century, information now flows farther and faster than ever before in history. Computers also enable the modern robotics that will have tremendously powerful social implications on the next century. Robotics has already changed the face of American manufacturing and productivity. Robotics enable a relatively small workforce to produce a prodigious amount of goods. They also put a high premium on intelligence, for if the machines do most of the manual labor, then the jobs left are the ones involving designing the computers, software, and the machines to do the labor and keeping these highly technical creations functioning. Computer-driven societies are rapidly becoming more and more dependent on intelligent populations. European-descended populations, which have largely engineered the computer robotics revolution, have low birth rates. Concurrent with the phasing out of some forms of manual labor by machines, the population explosion, as it exists in Western nations, is mostly composed of the non-white elements mostly unsuited for the computer age. Computer programming and technology demands mathematical capability beyond the ability of many whites and most blacks. We're not talking about the end user here. We're talking about the people who design the programs and the technology that make them possible. As these high-tech positions proliferate, proportionately fewer blacks will be able to fill them. A high-tech society clearly marks racial lines. A fundamental economic, political, and social clash looms, born of this racial difference that will play itself out in a tumultuous 21st century. In a democracy, when the underclass becomes a majority, the productive elite can expect massive expropriation, political corruption, and repression. There may be shiny, technologically advanced computers in the corridors of the federal government in Washington, D.C., but the city elected a semi-literate, crack-smoking whoremonger as its mayor. After he served time in jail, those same inept voters re-elected him. Such racial demarcation will become even clearer in the 21st century as robotics evolve and their capabilities to perform more jobs that are now filled by low-skilled labor. It will not be too long until advanced robots can take orders, flip hamburgers, and give them to the customer, wash and wax a floor, iron clothes, cut a yard and trim a hedge, or wash a sink full of dishes. Most McDonald's restaurants will choose to employ a robot that never misses work, never asks for a raise, never steals, and never requires payments for workers' compensation, medical insurance, or retirement benefits. It has been incorrectly stated that the cotton gin made Negro slaves obsolete. In reality, the cotton gin enabled the quick and easy processing of great amounts of cotton, fueling a demand for raw cotton and the continued slavery. What the cotton gin did not do the computer revolution and robotics are doing on a worldwide basis. As my chapters on black-white IQ differences showed, many blacks are even at present unemployable. The percentage of blacks in that category can only increase as the technological revolution continues. And, by the way, as differential black birth rates, as I talked about earlier, where the least intelligent blacks reproduce faster than the most intelligent blacks, continues. Another interesting aspect of the computer revolution is that it will enable a nation with a small population but high IQ to have tremendously disproportionate power. Robots can be programmed to make other robots, and those can make even still more. Theoretically, a very small but intelligently populated nation could have the capacity to produce as many televisions or automobiles or, for that matter, ballistic missiles as any of today's superpowers. Therefore, even if the white population becomes dangerously low in some nations, it will still be possible for whites somewhere in the world to build a society of immense economic and military power. The computer revolution has made this and many other things that we have not even dreamed of possible. Next section is democratization of information. In the early part of the 20th century, the Jews moved to greatly expand their influence in the traditional communication media of newspapers, books, and magazines. They also quickly captured the movie and broadcasting industries, which they have dominated ever since. The power and persuasiveness of film and television made the format irresistible and authoritarian. When Edward R. Murrow or Walter Cronkite appeared on their national television screens, for many of the undiscerning, it was almost as if God were talking to them. These figures seemed larger than life, and when the talking head spoke, it seemed almost sacrilegious to contradict them. People found themselves transported to a magical world where it seemed anything, even the most improbable or impossible, could seem real. The old adage, seeing is believing, translated into the most powerful form of propaganda the world has ever seen. A movie hero could jump from one flying jet to another jet's wing and make it look believable. Or the good guy could somehow escape bullets fired by 100 machine guns at close range. Slowly, though, some people became a bit suspicious of the media, and they began to realize that it could be very deceptive. But unless they had personal and direct knowledge of a person or an event, they still had a difficult time discerning the truth, for the media were in the hands of a chosen few. But with the advent of the transistor, silicon chip, and the modern computer, that began to change. Instead of the easily controlled few-to-many model of information, epitomized by the TV networks, we are now moving to a many-to-many paradigm. An intelligent person can now publish with a voice potentially as loud as the New York Times or CBS. The rise of the Internet makes it possible for any capable person to make a print, audio, visual presentation qualitatively as good as that of a multi-billion dollar corporation. Suddenly, information and ideas are no longer controlled by a monopoly of the rich, powerful, and connected. A website designer with a limited budget but good skills can make an internet page just as colorful, entertaining, and interesting as Michael Eisner's Walt Disney page or a printed page out of Gerald Levin's Time magazine. And more importantly, a person can see the page instantly and at no cost from almost anywhere in the world. The internet has led to a great democratization of information, allowing individuals to be at the cutting edge of communication for the first time since information was spread by a speech in the town square. It is still an advantage for big media powers such as the television network to promote their own or other approved websites, but not an insurmountable one. It is also true that once huge numbers of people begin to access a web page, there will be high costs for bandwidth, use of the expensive transmission lines needed to carry large amounts of data. But proportionately, the internet is by far the cheapest and fastest form of mass communication in the world. When I open my page at www.davidduke.com, almost immediately people began to visit my site and see and hear for themselves what I stood for rather than what the media says I believe in. The way the internet has caused a revolution in accessing information can be illustrated by the way thousands of students do school reports on me every year. Until the advent of the internet, if they wanted to learn about me, they had to go to their libraries and look up the Guide to Periodical Literature and find articles about David Duke in newspapers, magazines, and journals. More often than not, the articles written about me are from Jewish-owned liberal newspapers and magazines. And even if the writer is not himself Jewish, he is often ideologically and morally opposed to me. Even a writer who is personally neutral or even secretly sympathetic to my point of view knows what his Jewish or liberal employers expect of him in regard to coverage of David Duke. Often the press distorts my positions and beliefs, makes up bald-faced lies, quotes me erroneously or out of context, and plays up whatever they think will discredit me or play down anything about me that people might interpret as positive. In short, what people read about me in the major media is not what I say, but what the media says that I say. The internet changes all of that. Now when a high school or college student does a report about me, the typical way is for them to go on the web and search a web engine to find pages with the name David Duke. They will immediately find pages that attack me, which is fine by me, because they also will find my own page where with just a click of their mouse they can read for themselves what I actually believe in and what I stand for in my own words. I can use as much space as I deem necessary to explain my ideas, and I can provide the documentation that supports them. They can even hear me give a talk in my own voice without the biased editing of a hostile media hack. And of course, they can do what thousands are doing at this very minute, share this audio version of my awakening, and hear for themselves what I say and my facts and evidence, seeing it in my books rather than what the media says about me and alleges about my arguments and facts. With internet radio or video, anyone with a computer who is hooked up to the internet anywhere in the world can hear my radio programs on demand 24 hours a day. There are no studio costs, no huge expenditures for technical equipment, and there are no transmitter costs for a radio or TV station that can broadcast all over the world around the clock. My cost is the modest price I pay for the bandwidth used by those who are accessing my broadcast. That is increasing, of course, because of our huge reach, and your help in those matters is quite appreciated. Suddenly, the playing field is leveling. Ideas can now compete on their own merit rather than simply because people have the media power to promote them. The internet serves the truth like no other medium in the history of the world. People can judge for themselves what makes sense and what doesn't, as well as who is being hypocritical and deceitful, and who's being honest and straightforward. The internet allows cross-examination on every issue imaginable. I have no fear of free speech because I truly believe my position is consistent, factual, and defensible. Of course, the Wiesenthal Center and others are trying to stifle freedom of speech on the internet. They are like a false witness who is afraid to be cross-examined. A good example of the internet's power is very recently, and this is a note for the audio edition, Simon Wiesenthal recently suffered a very big expose in the Telegraph in London, exposing his history of lies and deceit. The article didn't really question any of his fundamental assertions about the Holocaust, but it truly exposed him. But the beauty is that the article was not simply one that appeared in the London newspaper. It went all over the world and is now being read by millions of people by way of the Internet. The Internet spreads a very, very powerful truth in a media, whereas years ago, most people would only hear positive things about Seemann Wiesenthal rather than his incredibly sordid, disgusting, deceptive, and lying history. What's more, the Internet is expanding at a tremendous pace, and within a decade, most people of European descent will be connected. Internet speeds and technology are improving rapidly, enabling in the near future the transmission of high-quality digitized audio and video. This will give any computer the potential power of a TV station that can broadcast quality video programming anywhere in the world. The Anti-Defamation League, hypocrites, and Seemann Wiesenthal crowd are getting so nervous that they are hysterically advocating so-called hate laws to block freedom of speech on the Internet. They know that when people have the opportunity to see and hear the other side of the Israeli-Palestinian question, that they will learn the naked truth of Jewish supremacism. They know that when people learn of the Jewish Soviet murder of tens of millions of Christians, they will see the hypocrisy of the never-ending hype of the Jewish Holocaust. When will we see a movie called Trotsky's List? Dr. Shockley's invention of the transistor also now makes it possible for a person with a $300 camera and a $300 computer to make a video documentary of a very high quality, dependent only on an individual's creative ability. And it will not be long before the video can be sent as easily as one sends an email today. People of European descent, the world over, will be the most Internet and email-connected people on the globe. The potential for awakening our people is tremendous. In Iran, the Ayatollah Khomeini undermined a powerful and strongly entrenched regime with simple audio cassettes. We can create a revolution in thought and action with video and audio and written material that can be transmitted on the Internet to millions of our people in a matter of seconds. In the future, almost every European will be connected to email and the Internet. Most will keep their address book on the Internet, and because of the inexpensive cost of disk storage space, most people will keep an electronic address book and continue to grow their whole lives. Those who keep email addresses can send a particular letter to their entire address book by a simple command, taking but a few seconds. Suppose someone with a personal address book of 1,000 people received a particularly thought-provoking article on the race issue from a friend. He could forward it immediately to all 1,000 people in his address book. The same could be done with an audio recording or even a powerful and entertaining video documentary on Jewish supremacism. Even if the item only impresses a few of his list, those who find it interesting will forward it to their own address books. The material can reach millions in only a matter of days. When I first started speaking publicly at LSU, I believed the truth would set us free. But at that time, I just did not have the means to reach the masses of people with my ideas fully expressed. Now, all that has changed, almost in the blink of an eye, or perhaps I should say, a twinkle in the eyes of Dr. William Shockley. I had the privilege to speak with Dr. Shockley a number of times over the telephone from the early 70s until shortly before his death in 1989. While he lived, I kept confidential the fact that I knew him because I knew that media association with me could only cause him more grief from the press. He always had a kind word of encouragement and told me that if he were but 30 years younger and healthier, he would campaign for me. He was a hard man, undiplomatic on a personal level, and unforgiving of error. He lived a life as stringent outside the laboratory as he did within it. About the time he died, the Internet revolution was just getting underway, and people began to see how it could change the world. I read some papers on the possibilities of cheap and easy mass communication, and it dawned on me that Dr. Shockley was not only a courageous advocate of my core beliefs, but that he has given me and all the Aryans on Earth the ultimate weapon in the struggle for our survival and evolutionary advancement. He gave us the means for the truth to stand on an equal footing with the powerful purveyors of the lie. Our last talk occurred during the hurricane season in Louisiana. In a conversation with him in the fall of 1988, not long before his death, he was uncharacteristically emotional. He told me that his invention of the transistor had no meaning unless our European genotype survived. Our unique genotype, he told me, is worth infinitely more than every invention in the history of the world. Our genes are the mother of invention and the source of every hope for the future. He discussed a beautiful and seemingly intelligent blonde actress in the news who had married a black actor. With a passion I was not used to from his usually dispassionate scientific persona, he said to me, quote, "The loss of our genes from our gene pool of our people is a tragedy beyond any we can imagine. For her loss is tragic to all the generations that came before her and to all the generations that would have carried her genes on into the future." "I would surrender the Nobel Prize," he pleaded, "even the achievement of the transistor, just to have prevented that sacrilege. You see, her genome is infinitely more magnificent than any transistor or computer chip in the world, and the loss of it is incalculable." He told me of his feeling of apprehension for our heritage and the terrible times ahead of us. I was aware of the fact that he was ill, and I told him that when a man is in the eye of the hurricane, he doesn't feel its power. It seems that the great men who changed the world seldom understand the ultimate power unleashed by their own creation. I shared with him my belief that he had succeeded in the struggle for our genetic heritage more than he ever knew, because he, more than any other man on Earth, put into motion the computer and communication revolution that would turn the tide of our racial struggle for survival. I told him that he gave us the most powerful weapon in the world, the most powerful weapon the world has ever seen, the power of the truth unleashed, a power that will take us from devolution and destruction to evolution and creation. He died the year that I was elected to public office, and although I missed the man I so admired, his spirit stayed with me, urging me on, even to this very moment. But even more importantly, each day, through the electronic revolution that he helped make possible, he empowers our revolution. Dr. Shockley forged for the truth an electronic Excalibur that we shall wield unto victory. In addition to Dr. Shockley, the other Galileo of our times is Dr. James Watson, the co-discoverer of the DNA. Watson, the most famous and respected scientist alive today in the 21st century, although far more cautious than Shockley, has expressed belief in racial and sexual differences and has supported eugenics. It is a wonderful thing for all our people to know that the two leading scientists of the modern age, Shockley and Watson, have the same core beliefs as presented by this book. The next section is The Ethnic War, A Short History. At the turn of the 20th century, the leaders of the world Jewish community had only a fraction of the power they would acquire by its end. They had only a slightly disproportionate impact in the primary forms of mass communication, which were then the printed media of newspaper, magazine, and book publishing. Their power in academia and government in the Western world had definite limits set by both law and custom. And in most Western societies, they had only limited social intercourse with the Gentile elite. In that period, their greatest power came from their wealth, as they had considerable presence in international banking and trade, and among them, richest financiers. Nations could rise or fall by what Theodor Herzl called, quote, their terrible power of the purse. Then, through a series of cataclysmic events, they made a rapid climb to world power that has been perhaps the most amazing in all of history. As much as the 20th century has been catastrophic for the white race, the century has been incredibly empowering for the Jewish people, their social and political power reaching undreamed of heights by its close. It seems apropos that a Jewish assassin, Princip, sparked the flames of the First World War by his murder of Austrian Archduke Francis Ferdinand in Sarajevo. For the act began the first of two world wars that dramatically augmented Jewish power. The First World War procreated the Jewish-led Soviet state and the murders of a much-hated enemy, the ruling Christian Tsar of Russia. It also directly laid the foundation of the Zionist state in Palestine. The British Mandate made a deal with the House of Rothschild to issue the Balfour Declaration, which promised Palestine to the Jews in return for bringing America into the war. Establishment of the Zionist state, though, had to wait until the end of the next great war. The origins of the Second World War, like the first, had significant Jewish involvement from 1933 onward, when world Jewry formally declared war on Germany. Their power of the press created a demonized perception of Germany and Western nations, and they skillfully used their considerable political influence behind the scenes to agitate for war. By the time shots were fired in Poland in 1939, the Allies had been psychologically primed and prepared for war. Although the media portray the Holocaust as the great tragedy of the Jewish people, Christian losses were far, far greater. Although the Jews suffered a grievous loss of life, the worldwide Jewish community emerged from the Second World War more powerful than ever before in their long history. The Holocaust story itself became a pivotal weapon in their post-war ascension to power. Far fewer Jews were in Central Europe due to displacement and war casualties, and as world power shifted to the United States, so did Jewish power. It became concentrated in America's geopolitical post-war ascendancy. From the nexus of the government bureaucracy and their media, they rose vis-a-vis the United States to world hegemony. Jewish media influence rapidly grew from the time of their purchase near the turn of the century of America's most famous newspaper, the New York Times. Over the next decades, they greatly widened their presence in print media and then turned their attention to the enormously powerful forms of mass communication, radio, films, and television. An effective team effort squeezed out the Gentile inventors and innovators of the motion picture industry. Men such as Thomas Edison and D. Deborah Griffith were elbowed aside by the Goldwyns, Mayers, and Warners, and Selznicks, and the chosen reigned as sovereign rulers over what Jewish film critic Neil Gabler aptly calls the title of his book, An Empire of Their Own. Correctly perceiving the immense power of radio and television broadcasting to advance their political and social objectives, David Sarnoff, William Paley, and Leonard Goldenson, the prime movers of NBC, CBS, and ABC, moved swiftly to dominate and consolidate broadcasting. These three warm Jews, meaning Jews who put Jews first, whose families fled from the Russian Tsars, effectively used the news and entertainment media to advance Jewish objectives. At the beginning of the 20th century, Jewish financial power was mostly limited to their most famous profession, moneylending. However, in the first two decades, they also gained strategic positions in the political and economic sectors throughout the world, using their wealth to barter their way into the council of presidents and premiers. They dominated international banking and trade. Jewish financiers such as Jacob Schiff and Bernard Baruch controlled billions of dollars in the international financial houses and stock exchanges. Schiff was able to assemble the financing of the successful Japanese war against the Russians, which weakened the Tsar and paved the way for Bolshevik Jewish revolution. Jewish financiers jumped at the chance to finance all the antagonists of the First World War. In the desperation of that war, international Jewish financiers became indispensable to men such as the American President Woodrow Wilson, British Prime Minister Lloyd George, French Premier Georges Clemenceau, and the German Kaiser. In contrast, their financial boycott of Imperial Russia wrote the death warrant for the Tsar and his family. In America, Bernard Baruch, Jacob Schiff, and a host of others consolidated their power over the American banking system with the passage of the Federal Reserve Act. Since its passage in 1913, the Federal Reserve Corporation, a privately held concern that ostensibly has its top posts appointed by the President of the United States, has been greatly influenced by Jewish bankers and economists right up to the current chairman, Ben Shalom Bernanke. In the political realm, Jews established themselves as the chief fundraisers and contributors in both political parties in America, to the extent that the Clinton White House became an exclusive hotel for the richest and most powerful Jewish moneymen and Hollywood czars. They also influenced many key political parties in Europe and insinuated themselves into the highest echelons of governments on both sides of the Atlantic. By the 1930s, they had amassed great power in newspapers, radio, theater, movies, and book publishing. Combining their media power with their governmental influence, the Jews fomented the fratricide of the Second World War. They had to destroy the one great remaining threat to them on a global scale, National Socialist Germany. After the war began, they also sought to protect their Soviet creation from German conquest. Their accumulation of extensive government and media power by the end of the Second World War led to the achievement of their messianic dream. For 2,000 years, next year in Jerusalem was their daily prayer, and now next year had arrived. The Jewish supremacist Zionist state came into being, built through the military conquest and dispossession of the Palestinians. Israel was not a nation established to gather all the Jews of the world, but as an inviolable center from which to coordinate their new world power. At the same time that they displaced the Palestinians, they accelerated their efforts to demonize, criminalize, and marginalize all who would resist their supremacism. They consolidated their power in media and their power behind the scenes in government and finance skillfully. They launched a well-organized attack against every aspect of the traditional white establishment. They taught egalitarianism in academia and the media to destroy white racial consciousness and solidarity, and a possible defense against their own solidarity. They spearheaded the effort to open the borders of America and the Western nations to the Third World. They taught guilt and supplication among whites for slavery, Third World exploitation, and the Holocaust. They instilled resentment and hatred in growing non-white racial minorities to use as a weapon of division in white countries. They led the legal and government assault on white schools and neighborhoods. They helped the family through feminism, lower moral standards, and economic restructuring. They helped to undermine the family through feminism, lower moral standards, and economic restructuring. After the passage of 2,000 years, they could now act in earnest against their many enemies who defeated and dispersed them. They would finally have the revenge against the Gens, the Roman ruling families from which comes the name Gentiles. The descendants of Esau would finally get to feel the wrath of Jacob. By the end of the Second World War, they had the power to exact their revenge on the Goy. More than enough power. The West was exhausted from the fratricidal conflict. The partisans of the New World Order knew that they could control the media and through it the politicians. No one could stand in their way. Knowing that this ethnic war is one fought on the quiet battlefields of political and economic power, they understand that it is primarily a psychological war. To win it, they must make an intensive team effort, while at the same time they must destroy the spirit of their competitors. In every war, there are accusations against the enemy of atrocities and mass murder, and this war was no different. They realized that they could disguise their own supremacism and at the same time lessen Gentile solidarity by intensifying, long after the war propaganda against the Germans. After successfully creating post-war German guilt for the Holocaust, they saw the opportunity to do the same to all Gentile worldwide nations by ingraining the horrors of the Holocaust in every racial European. They could insulate and protect themselves from criticism and remove the moral justification for European ethnic self-defense. By simply equating this self-defense with the horrors of the Holocaust. Ultimately, using their power in mass media, international Jewry even succeeded in displacing the Second World War as the central event of the 20th century. Ion J. Kagadan, director of governmental relations of the B'nai B'rith, stated that, quote, "The Holocaust stands as Western civilization's greatest failure." He goes on, "Achieving our quest of a new world order depends on our learning the Holocaust's lessons." Unquote. The Holocaust became the most written about, spoken about, and cried about event in the history of the world. The war itself simply became the Holocaust's context. Never mind the other 40 million or 50 million casualties of the war. Jewish suffering became the central issue of the conflict. A temple to commemorate the Holy Holocaust was consecrated in Washington, D.C., amongst the most sacred of American government monuments, long before there was any move to build a major memorial to commemorate the American sacrifices and losses in the Second World War. Not only were Jewish school children taught a fresh story of Haman and the personage of Hitler, but we and our children have been subjected to never-ending, decades-long lectures decrying the ultimate guilt of our entire Gentile world. They successfully expanded the responsibility for the evil far beyond the Germans. It grew to include the Poles, Slovaks, Ukrainians, French, even the Americans and the British must now bear the guilt for not doing enough to prevent the calamity and for denying entrance to refugees. Finally, even traditional European Christianity is blamed for laying the groundwork for anti-Semitism, with nary a mention of the hateful intolerance of the Talmudic powers of Judaism. Through the powerful modern media, film, and television, every Jew learns of the evil and murderous nature of the Gentiles and their need for solidarity and activism for the Jewish agenda and for Israeli intransigence and horror. Jewish self-justification and supremacism soars to new heights. Gentiles also learn their lesson that any resistance against Jewish domination is morally equivalent to the horrors of the Holocaust, even to criticize Jews for tens of thousands of civilian deaths in Palestine and for their wholesale denial of human rights is equated with anti-Semitism and thus painted as morally equivalent to the Holocaust. Through the power of their media control, the most racist extremists on earth successfully present themselves as victims of racism. Anyone who exposes Jewish hatreds of their ethnic enemies becomes accused of hatred. The people who present themselves as a morally and intellectually superior people, supposedly chosen by God, hypocritically characterize Gentiles who dare to oppose Jewish supremacism as hateful anti-Semites. Only through their domination of the media could such an inversion of reality be foisted upon the public. Every leading Gentile public figure learns to prostrate himself before the chosen people and beg them for their blessings and forgiveness. And every young Gentile learns the media lesson that those who dare to oppose the chosen people are the epitome of evil, and that those who oppose them, by the way, will pay a terrible price. The way became clear for our traditional enemy. They expanded their control of the media, and they're still trying to tie up loose ends. Every politician in America learns that it's possible to oppose the NRA or the tobacco lobby, but opposing the Jewish lobby is political suicide. No government of the West will dare oppose them, including, as much as it pains me to say it, the government of my own beloved nation, the United States of America. As I showed in my chapter on Zog, even their own pundits in the Israeli press boast that America no longer has a government of Gentiles. We are now in an occupied land, and we can see Zog's handiwork across the breadth. Now in what they believe are their final stages of conquest and consolidation, they have even begun to destroy centuries-old Western traditions of free thought and speech. The former Jewish head of the European Parliament, Simone Veil, promotes imprisonment for anyone who dares to even question the Jewish interpretation of history. Blinded by the false glow of the controlled media, we allow our hard-won freedoms to be taken away with hardly a peep of protest. For daring to contradict Jewish views, men are at this moment in jail in Germany, France, England, Italy, Canada, Spain, and elsewhere. If a man points out Jewish hatred of Gentiles, he's called a hate criminal and a hate monger. It is now called hate crime to expose hate crimes, to seek the same rights for our own people that Jews seek for themselves is called hate. To seek the preservation of our own way of life and our own standards of art and beauty is called hate. To have a different opinion of historical events than the Jewish approved version is called hate. Freedom of speech is called hate. Freedom of thought is called hate. To defend freedom of speech is a hate crime. After centuries, the Jewish extremists are now finally free to exact their revenge for actions of Pharaoh, Haman, Caesar, and Hitler. They revel in our dispossession and our degeneration. They set loose Sigmund Freud's sexual degeneracy and the modern feminism of Bella Abzug, Betty Friedan, and Gloria Steinem to break the bonds of our families. They set loose the egalitarianism of Franz Boas, Ashley Montague, and Stephen Jay Gould to destroy our understanding of race. They set loose the alienism of Emma Lazarus, Emanuel Seller, and Jacob Javits to break down our borders and flood our nation with millions of non-Europeans. They set loose the forces of Kibbe Kaplan and Jake Greenberg of the NAACP to destroy our schools and our cities with integration and black crime. They set loose the hideous sub-art of Jacob Epstein and Jack Lipschitz, the scatological scribblings of Norman Mailer, and the perversion of Allen Ginsberg to poison our spirits. They set loose Michael Milken, Ivan Boesky, and Meyer Lansky to defraud us. And I might add today, the likes of Bernie Madoff. They set loose filmmaker Stanley Kramer to tell us to give our daughters to non-Europeans, and Steven Spielberg to tell us to give our souls to the Jews. They set loose the zero population preacher of Paul Ehrlich to tell us to have no more children, and teachers like Dr. Spock to tell us not to discipline and strengthen the ones that we do have. They set loose Seaman Wiesenthal and Abraham Foxman to take away even our right to free speech. The 20th century has been a century of Jewish supremacist power, and the most devastating and dangerous 100 years in the long history of the white race. It continues now in the 21st century. Our political sovereignty has been supplanted in our own nations, and now even our very existence is threatened in our own homelands. America, Canada, England, France, Australia, Italy, Ireland, even the sparsely populated Scandinavian nations of Norway and Sweden have rapidly growing non-white minorities. In the most powerful Western nation, America, and our sister nation, Canada, whites are only a few short years away from becoming a minority. Now is the time for us to create and enact our own evolutionary strategy, our own blueprint for our race's survival, and the continuation of our evolutionary advancement. Next section is A White Evolutionary Strategy. In this volume, I have written much about the disastrous effects of Jewish power in the Western world. It is true that their power could not have been achieved without their deceit, but it must be admitted that neither could it have been accomplished without their considerable abilities and a number of admirable traits. Their survival in a multicultural world would not have been possible otherwise. Jewish extremists developed ideologies that support the preservation of the genotype. At its core, Judaism is an evolutionary strategy for the preservation and advancement of the Jewish genetic and cultural heritage. Their scriptures express their religion's relationship with God, not in a spiritual afterlife, but in promises of power for the Jewish people right here on earth if they obey His laws. Central to these laws is preservation of their genetic heritage. Ultimately, Judaism has even cast the Jewish people as being greater than God. Only within the Jewish religion could their most loyal holy writ describe incidents where rabbis defeat God in argument and prove God wrong, or scriptures in which rabbis dispute His existence or even mock Him. For Jews, God has become in many ways synonymous with themselves. For instance, hitting a Jew is the same as hitting God. References for this are in my written and published edition. Zionism became a secularized version of this supremacism, which, as per secular Israel, permits Judaism to remain in place as a eugenic mechanism and guardian of the Jewish genotype. In deference to the racial principle, even atheist Jews support the religious racial superstructure of their people. Other Jewish strategies can be summarized as follows. They have stressed education and prized scholarship. They have actively encouraged the most intelligent and successful of their race to have the largest families. They have kept alive their history, traditions, culture, and values. While they have worked together as a team to advance their objectives in the Gentile community, they have stressed individual responsibility. They have stressed the importance of the family unit among their own. They speak against intermarriage and elevate genetic purity as one of their highest values. Members of the Jewish priest class are only the purest of Jews. In other words, they are forbidden to marry converts or the descendants of converts. Successful and powerful Jews are extremely generous to Jewish causes and never reluctant to use their power on behalf of their own people. All these traits are admirable, and in the multicultural societies we live in, we can learn from these successful moral strategies. Of course, the reason why the Jewish problem exists is the fact that they inflict on their host peoples an opposite morality to their own. If their host people would have practiced values similar to that of Jews, the Jews could have never accrued power in Gentile societies. They learn to survive by stoking their own ethnocentrism, while at the same time they intentionally weakened their host's well-being, solidarity, and self-esteem. Such a goal is perfectly realized in Spielberg's Schindler's List, a film that increases Jewish solidarity and distrust of Gentiles, while at the same time decreases Gentile resistance against Jewish power. Jewish dual morality explains the fierce Jewish opposition to the Euro-American eugenic movement during the early 20th century. While Jews have solemnly promoted eugenic practices among themselves for thousands of years, it explains why they encourage racial intermarriage for Gentiles while opposing intermarriage for Jews, why they support group loyalty and solidarity among Jews but attack those principles among Gentiles, and why they orchestrate open immigration into Western nations but rigidly restrict immigration to Israel only to Jews. If we are to survive, Aryans must adopt similar strategies, but without the Jewish hypocrisy. Aryans must have a movement and ideology that defines the preservation of our racial heritage as the highest act of morality, and the destruction of it as the greatest crime. Aryans must adopt a team strategy and solidarity. Aryans must support education, scholarship, and economic self-sufficiency among our own ranks. Aryans must be racially altruistic and financially supportive of the movement for our racial survival, now more than ever. Aryans must be intensively supportive of the family and look at the well-being, education, and training of our children as a holy obligation. While these values have similarity to those of the Jews, we must at the same time recognize that our genotype is fundamentally different from theirs. Our racial patriotism does not aspire to supremacy over other races, but simply sovereignty in our own societies. We envision ourselves as an organic and evolving genotype, celebrating our European values and reaching for the stars, and we unhypocritically understand and support the natural right and impulse of all races to pursue those same ideals on behalf of their own genotype. We do not seek to rule over or exploit other races. We want only to create our own society structured on our own culture and dedicated to promoting our most noble attributes. We wish the same kind of fulfillment for the other races of mankind in the distinct societies that will reflect their own natural traits and character. Unlike Jewish supremacists, we don't preach one morality for us and another for the other peoples of the world. We are consistent and act with a clear conscience and a good spirit, and we respect those of other races who seek their own ideals. Unlike the Jews, we Aryans refuse to wallow in mournful mythologies of past persecutions, but instead focus on and celebrate our triumphant sagas. We will not dwell on past suffering, but seek heroic lives in the present and never-ending future glories. We want a future society not based on chronic recitals of the evils of our historic enemies, but one that celebrates the spirit and beauty of our heroes and heroines. We don't wallow in stories of woe, but are inspired by heroism and achievement. We are a culture of life, not of death. The next section is White Strategy for Victory. The antagonistic Jewish minority in the West relies on deception to maintain and augment their power, deception made possible by their domination of the mass media and their undue influence in government. They have for generations been bred for that duplicity, while we were bred in our European homelands to place honesty and honor as high virtues. Our instincts compel us to truthfulness. Only through our virtues can we prevail, not our sins. We will never successfully sneak up on our enemies, for the masters of deception are the rulers of the shadows, while we thrive in the light. Our ranks must be bathed in the light of truth. Today, the field of engagement is the debating hall, the political campaign, the family gathering, are just a simple conversation with our people wherever they may be. Our weapons are books and videos and all forms of written and spoken word. And today, email, websites, and chat rooms. You hold one of these weapons in your hands in terms of the computer in front of you or the MP3 player that enables you to hear this book in a spoken form. Every awakened white person becomes an Aryan, a racially conscious white person dedicated to our survival and evolutionary advancement. As Aryan numbers grow, we will form a bond as powerful for our race as Judaism has been for Jews. Our real strength can only come from our utter dedication to the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. That truth can be harsh. It can be costly. It can generate our persecution from those who cannot stand its light. But truth, the whole truth, is the only possible path to our eventual victory. Europeans have never chosen to be the enemy of the Jews. Our ancestors tried repeatedly to assimilate its Jewish interlopers for over 2,000 years. We offer them every advantage of our culture, religion, and societies, asking only that they respect our ways and our God. Nevertheless, while the Jews enjoyed all the benefits of living in our advanced societies rather than the squalid realms from whence they came, extremists only became more jealous of us. Every open hand and open church door was met with more defiance and ethnocentrism. They chose to destroy the very societies that gave them refuge. They chose ethnic war. Our people have long tried to avoid the conflict. We have tried to ignore it, to pretend it didn't exist, and vainly hope that it would go away. No longer. We now know that we cannot ignore the assaults of those who are at this moment planning our genocide. If we are to perish, we shall go to our fate as Aryan warriors, not as whimpering dogs licking the hand of the master who whips them. Every white person must realize that there is no easy way to win the struggle for our survival. Our champions, if they are true, will feel the wrath of our enemies. For we cannot win our war for survival unless we name the group that has chosen to be our enemy. We must defend our cultural, political, and genetic ramparts. Our race cannot survive unless we acknowledge that the races of man do exist and that our race is in mortal danger. We must make all of our kinsmen understand that our very survival is at stake. And we can never have a real and permanent victory unless we understand what true victory is, a revolution of thought and action that will preserve our genotype and move our people toward a higher evolutionary destiny. Furthermore, there is no way to stop a worldwide coordinated effort against our folk without a corresponding universal effort. Although our philosophy recognizes the right of each nation and heritage within the West to maintain its ethnic, cultural, and political distinctiveness, all Aryans worldwide must be united in our racial defense, whether we are English or Irish, Teutonic or Slav, Scandinavian or Italian, Basque or Spaniard, Croat or Serb. Our slogan is simple: white pride worldwide. We are one greater blood, one faith, one folk, and we will have one overriding quest: the survival and evolutionary advancement of our people. Wherever we live on the earth, we shall share the same vision, the same sense of beauty, the same courage and sense of duty and honor. We shall triumph together. Next section is practicalities. Although we must name the enemy and state with conviction what we fight for, we still must know that this is an ethnic war that must be strategically fought on all fronts. As in all wars, we must fight intelligently and sometimes covertly. Not every Aryan need shout from the rooftops his creed, but every Aryan must act to support the leaders who do this. Some Aryans can best help by supplying the real ammunition of the fight, money, and others with influence, and others with simply their tireless work. Some will fight politically, some socially, some religiously, some financially, and some even physically before the victory is won. But every Aryan must fight in the way that he can contribute the most. Aryans should not retreat from the institutions of society, but remain in them and transform them into our own instruments. By the way, that's exactly the same thing that the Jewish enemy has done over the years. These extremists have gained control over our own institutions. And we must strive to bring all Europeans in those institutions to Aryan awareness. Aryan political leaders must not and will not remain silent in military service, government, business, high school, or Sunday school. On campuses, Aryans will spread our message of racial survival, freedom, life. We will do whatever we must do to ensure that our people shall live. Some of our ranks will quietly go their way, building our base, increasing our power, widening our influence, turning the wheels of revolution from within the system. Others will be on the tabletops and the rooftops, shouting our truths. At the same time we work to transform the institutions of our society, we must create a parallel Aryan community where we gather together for fellowship and direction, inspiration, and education. An Aryan community can be as small as a handful of students in a high school sharing their Aryan brotherhood, or a whole city, county, or state led by Aryan activists. And so it must be until our awakened ones lead our nation and every nation of the Western world to victory. Women and the revolution. In an ideal world, women would not have to go to war. But there have been times in our history when women have had to pick up the pitchfork or the rifle to protect kith and kin. We are now in a struggle for the very survival of our race on this planet. Women are full participants in our revolution and in the natural order ahead, for although the sexes are profoundly different, we are made so that those differences harmonize with each other to forge the genetic soul of our race. In this worldwide racial emergency, women's participation in our cause is vital. Jewish feminism has tried to drive men and women apart. It is our task for our men and women to forge a sacred bond in this struggle for our survival. Gifted women naturally must have the right to pursue careers in any area of professional expertise. Hopefully, though, they will make marriage and children a vital concern, not just for the nation, but also for their well-being and that of their family. When having beautiful and intelligent children becomes as fashionable for those exceptional women as having the best designer clothes, magnificent homes and sleek cars, and career success, we will be moving toward the natural order with all deliberate speed. A message to the young. It must be understood that an Arian is simply not one who believes, but one who is dedicated and thus acts on the belief of our people. The original meaning of the word Arian in Sanskrit is noble one, and every Arian must know that he advances our cause not only by what he believes and his activism for the cause, but also by how nobly he lives his life. The ultimate proof of being an Arian is the exemplary life he lives. Our people need leaders by example. The way an Arian activist lives is just as important as the truth that he tells. The more accomplished, successful, and honorable the Arian, the more it can do for our cause. In 1998, I received an email from a young man named Ben Smith. He told me that he was 15 years old, that he believed deeply in our cause, and that he wanted to become an Arian. Here is how I answered him with an email. Dear Ben, it is great to hear that you're dedicated to your people. We're in a fight for our freedom and heritage even more important than the American Revolution or the ideals of the Alamo. You want to be an Arian. The first thing you must know is that there is a great difference between wanting and achieving. Being Arian is all about achieving, not simply wanting. You're in the formative stages of your life, so your first task for the cause is to make yourself grow stronger, physically, mentally, emotionally. You must evolve to a higher level the same way you want our race to go upward. If you really believe in our cause and want to be a true Arian warrior, you must become a leader among your fellow European Americans. Study hard and discipline yourself to learning, for knowledge is power. In everything you do, be an example of excellence and achievement. Let your conduct exemplify the ideals that you believe in, and that means being honest, honorable, and noble. Keep your body healthy, exercise, and unleash the strength that is coiled in your genes. The leaders of our race need to be strong and attractive in the Greek ideal of body, mind, and spirit. Become a man that other men admire and that women desire. Only if you are strong can you make our race strong as well. Reject the Jewish degeneracy sponsored by the mass media, and stay away from smoking and drugs, and refrain from irresponsible behavior with alcohol or sex. Force yourself to study and concentrate in class and achieve true accomplishment and success in your career and life. If you find little discipline at home or at school, then discipline and steel yourself by the power of your own will. Become an example of what an Arian is. For an Arian is not simply a white person. An Arian is a racially conscious white person dedicated to the evolutionary survival and advancement of our people. You prove that by your bearing and your actions. It also means staying legal and law-abiding. If someday the time comes for physical self-defense and revolution, you must be ready for that. But now our movement can only succeed through the power of the word, not the sword. If a spiritual revolution does not sweep our people, a physical and political one can never come. In addition to what you learn in school, you must learn the scientific facts of race and expand your knowledge until you can win every debate. Not only must you learn the basis of your beliefs, but also how to present them effectively. I know that some of the things I'm telling you may sound difficult. Sometimes you cannot help but fall short of your own ideals. But it is in the relentless striving that makes you a true Arian. In the same way, the striving of our race will lead to a higher man. The next few decades will be the most exciting and important in the long history of our people. And you will have the chance to be in the midst of the most important revolution in the history of mankind. You will accomplish great things in your life if you just dare to have great dreams and then act upon them with discipline. So, if you really want to be a true Aryan, your task at 15 is to reach down into the depths of your soul and find what is noble in your genes, and then give that nobility expression in your very life. Sculpture a strong, healthy body. Educate your mind. Nourish your spirit and steel your will. Become an Aryan and help usher in the natural order of the coming age. It is your destiny, my friend. Sincerely, David Duke. The next chapter is chapter 42, What We Must Do Now.